Committee on Higher Education for Wednesday, March 28, 2007. Welcome to all who are here. The other committee members will be filing as soon as they can get out of the meetings that we've all been pulled into. We are here to hear a couple of bills that are very important for higher education, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2578. Mr. Olson, if you'd be so kind as to review what this bill is all about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2578 specifies the percentage of undergraduate courses to be taught by full-time tenured and tenure-track faculty at public institutions of higher education in Oregon. It directs public institutions of higher education to determine the salary standard for part-time and adjunct faculty based on salary of tenured or tenured and tenure-track faculty. It directs that part-time and adjunct faculty are eligible for certain benefits and receive preferential consideration for attaining tenure-track faculty positions. The bill would establish the Oregon University System Faculty Restoration and Equity Fund, as well as the Community College Faculty Restoration and Equity Fund. The bill would continuously appropriate money in each fund to the Department of Higher Education or the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development as appropriate for distribution to public institutions of higher education. Members of the committee, you have before you the staff measure summary. It has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. There is no fiscal impact statement yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a large number of people who wish to testify on this bill today. So I'm going to ask folks as they come forward, if you have written testimony, please don't feel you need to read your entire written testimony. We will read it when you give us copies of it. If you could highlight from your written testimony. I'd also ask you to pay attention if another speaker has already made the points that you desire to make. You can simply tell us that you wish to agree with those points made. And given the number of speakers, your estimated time would be about 2 minutes each if you want to be fair to other people who are here also to testify on this bill. Looking at the list, we only have one person who marked down that they are here from over 100 miles away. We'll make sure that person does get a chance to testify. And if need be, if everyone does not get a chance to testify today, we will have a second hearing on this bill to make sure we get everyone's testimony in. That said, I'd also like to ask you to, if you have a cell phone, to please not just turn it down, but to turn it off, because the sound system in this room does react rather violently to the use of cell phones, even if you have them in the volume off position. At this point, we'd like to call forth the first panel of proponents for the bill, Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rob Wagner, Bill Schuerman, and Michael Dembrow. Can you please come to the witness stand? Thank you.
So this one. Members, just for your information, there is a gentleman taking photos in the front row. I said it was okay for him to do. My hometown newspaper is doing a profile. I think the headline is going to be, "What were you thinking when you voted for this man?"
Sorry. He may be a good actor, but...
Gentlemen, welcome.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers, and they were thinking great things, Chair Buckley.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to keep my testimony very brief. I do have I've submitted written testimony. I'm not going to read it. I just want to say that we are thrilled to be here today to support the Faculty and College Excellence Act contained in House Bill 2578. If you see the stickers of all the folks out in the, and that's what the FACE campaign is about. And Mr. Schuerman is going to tell you a little bit more about what's going on both nationally, and we have lots of members that are going to tell you about the excitement around this legislation here in Oregon. I will just say that in terms of the bill, it's very comprehensive legislation, and it's built around two central pieces to the staffing puzzle. If you saw the Oregonian last couple of days, there was this campaign ad that we've started to take out, and it has two puzzle pieces that we're trying to put together. The first piece is addressing full-time faculty in terms of better pay in order to recruit and retain quality full-time faculty. The second piece is that we need to address equal pay and benefits for equal work for our committed part-time faculty and the recognition for the central role that they play in the academic excellence of our community colleges and universities. Each of you has a packet that's going around that's being distributed right now. And I will just say that AFT has taken the lead in previous legislative sessions in a very piecemeal fashion in trying to address issues around the faculty staffing crisis. In 1997, Dan Gardner had a bill addressing full-time, part-time ratios. We've had bills addressing access to health care benefits and unemployment insurance for part-time faculty, and even a study of the problem, and none of which has gained legislative support. This is the most complete legislation we've seen addressing a faculty staffing crisis in a very comprehensive fashion. And I will say, just picking up on the thread of the Oregonian editorial from Monday, which in the opinion section it said, higher ed, always the loser. This is our attempt to start to move and shift the debate, swim against the tide, and start rebuilding quality into our post-secondary institutions. We appreciate the House, for the first time, having a subcommittee directly responsible for higher education issues, and we're thrilled to be here today. With that, I will just turn it over to Mr. Schumerman and Mr. Denbrough. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity of coming here. I appreciate your clear rules. I'm not going to read the testimony. I will not talk, even though I'm from New York, I will not talk as quickly as my colleague. But again, I want to thank you. My name is Bill Scheumann. I'm an AFT Vice President. AFT represents 1.3 million members across the country, 160,000 of whom are in higher ed. 60,000 of that 160,000 are contingent workers, and we're very concerned about what happens to contingent workers and the impact of universities and colleges' dependence on contingent workers for the quality of education and the way they're treating and exploiting many of these workers. And I'll begin by saying what's happening in Oregon. You just heard Rob talk about higher ed finishes last. It's nothing new. It happens everywhere, I'm sorry to say. For the past 15 years, state budgets have all been under the gun. I don't have to tell you folks about it. You know it better than me. And then there's competition from other sectors. Years ago, it was the prisons and crime, and now it's health care. And money was constantly drained from the coffers of public higher ed to other sectors. Don't always agree why, but it was something that happened, and it was probably essential at the time. But over a period of years, higher ed took a lot of hits. And you can do it in the short run, and you can do it this year, and another year, and another year. But after 8, 10, 12, 15 years of that, you start to see the implications. And I just want to talk a little bit about the implications nationally. The first major implication is loss of full-time faculty. In 1970, about 80% of all faculty were full-time faculty. So a student could go to college. When the student graduated, could get a letter of recommendation, that person was probably still going to be there, would have a mentor, could go to the office, have an advisor, had a problem, could talk about class grades. Well, that's all changed. Now 54% are full-time faculty. So almost nationally, almost half the faculty are part-time, making it more difficult for students to find faculty members. You know why? These faculty members, many of our part-time colleagues, are so poorly paid, they don't get health care, they have to cobble an existence together by teaching at two or three different institutions. Often they're not renewed at the last minute, and there's great personnel changes. You're going to hear at one institution in the state of Oregon, the turnover is 25% annually. That creates chaotic conditions for students. The conditions I just described are worse at the community college level. Some community colleges, 70%, 75% of the faculty are part-timers. Now, part-timers do a good job, but the problem is they're often not given the tools to do their job. As I said, many have to cobble several jobs together to make a living. Others, good number, aren't even given office hours, aren't even given offices. So if a student wants to see a faculty member, where do you see them? In the car, as they get on the road to go to the next job? And we sometimes call our colleagues road scholars, and that's a painful that's a painful thing to say for our colleagues and for the students who depend on them. So it creates other implications for the full-time faculty who remain as the pool gets smaller. More responsibilities in the area of governance, advisement, research are piled onto a smaller group, which makes it more difficult to provide the services that the students need. And in the equation, the group that's hurt the most is going to be the students. So we at AFT are launching a national campaign called FACE, the FACE legislation, and we're trying to do two things with FACE. First, we're trying to ensure that all faculty members receive the financial and professional support they need. So if you're hired to be a part-time faculty member, pay a decent salary, provide an office, provide the materials so the person can do the job. And secondly, we want to establish a better balance between the number of part-timers and the number of full-timers. It used to be 80%. We'd like to see it go back to a 75-25% ratio. Will this happen this year? Probably not in our best dreams. But it's a start. And over the next few years, we think that should be a target that all state legislatures should look at, so that 5 or 10 years from now, this crisis is over, and when a family pays tuition to send a student to college, they know they're going to get a real quality education, and not an education that they're paying high tuition, but what's being financed on the cheap for whatever reasons. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. My name is Michael Dembro, and I teach English at Portland Community College, which I have done for 25 years now. I am also the president of the Portland Community College Faculty Federation, which represents 600 faculty, full-time faculty and academic professionals, and 1,200 part-time faculty over the course of a year. I'm also a vice president for AFT Oregon, and I've recently had the honor of being appointed to the State Board of Education as its first community college faculty advisor. When I started at TCC 25 years ago, I taught at the Cascade campus, which was a small campus. It's not so small now. And I was the part-timer at TCC Cascade in my department in English. There were four full-timers, and I was the part-timer to teach the three sections that were offered part-time. Today, just this last term, there were 13 part-timers. And over the course of a year, there will be 15 part-timers in my department. Now, this places enormous stresses on our departments, on our college. It increases our administrative costs to have to deal with this number of part-time faculty. And it also obliges more and more full-time faculty to be released from their teaching duties in order to coordinate the work of the part-timers as department chairs. It places enormous stresses, obviously, on the part-time faculty themselves, who are, for the most part, doing really excellent work, but are very, very scattered. Back when I started teaching, the norm was that you would find part-time faculty in the career technical areas, and that made a lot of sense. They would come in and from their primary jobs and share their expertise with the students, and it was really a good thing. But increasingly over the years, it's the core courses, the core curriculum, where you're going to find more and more part-time faculty. In our nursing program, for example, we have very few part-timers, and that's because they're required by their state licensing agencies to hire full-time. We don't have that responsibility, that requirement in the core areas. And so as a result, when we find ourselves with growing enrollment or a declining funding structure, where is the softest place, where administrators can look to balance the budget? And what they do is they convert full-time positions into part-time or just hire part-time. And the effects of this are very serious on students as well. You probably know that one of the top guarantors of student success is the degree to which they have access to their faculty. And this is really being compromised today. In your packets, you'll find a bibliography, a selected bibliography of some of the growing literature on this subject of the impact of an over-reliance on part-timers on student success, and you'll see that increasingly the evidence is that it results in lowered graduation rates, lowered retention rates, and an increase in grade inflation. Faculty organizations have been working on this issue for many years. As Rob mentioned, a study was commissioned in the late 90s. It was actually attached to a budget note, I think, in 1999. And this study set up a task force. I was on that task force, and I have to tell you, it was one of the most frustrating experiences of my professional life, because unfortunately, for the most part, the college presidents refused to be part of the process. In the words of one of the campus leaders, this is like letting the foxes into the hen house. And they were very obstructive about it, despite the best efforts of the Commissioner of Community Colleges Workforce Development. As a result of this process, it just kind of imploded. I think it resulted in information from three colleges, and that was really inadequate. So that brings us to this bill, which is omnibus attempt to deal with this problem on many fronts. You're going to hear vigorous opposition to this, I'm sure, from the college and university management. You're going to hear them say that this violates the principle of local control. Give us more money, which I agree, we definitely need more money. We are very inadequately funded, but you're going to hear, give us the money, we'll deal with the problem. But unfortunately, the record is not good on that. The local control is certainly a very important concept, but we also feel that the state has a responsibility in setting broad guidelines about issues related to quality. The particulars of how to implement those quality concerns, that can be worked out at the local level in accord with these broad outlines. One of the elements of the bill, you'll see, is to make staffing levels a mandatory subject of bargaining. Right now, despite the fact that campus leaders are saying that this is a local issue, when we're in negotiations, those of us who have collective bargaining, and we want to talk about this issue, we're told, no, this is a permissive subject of bargaining. This is not mandatory, and you know what? We're not going to talk about it. And so we can make no progress at that level. You will also hear, of course, as I mentioned, that just give us the money and we'll solve the problem. But, the evidence is not good for that. If you're probably starting to receive, or at least I hope you're starting to receive from the Oregon Community College Association information from the different schools of what a higher allocation would mean to them. I received these a couple of weeks ago for Central, for Clatsop, and for Oregon Coast. And in all three of those colleges, you only see one reference to creating a full-time position, and that's at Clatsop, because it wants to expand its nursing program. So it's just not clear that without some guidance from the legislature that we're going to see this issue addressed. Finally, you'll hear that this bill is an unfunded mandate. In fact, as you'll see, the bill does set up a fund, which we hope will be funded as soon as possible. But in the meantime, it does also contain elements that are not directly revenue-driven. And those could certainly be implemented immediately. Those that rely on funding, this is obviously going to be a multi-biennia issue. This is a problem that was a long time coming and it will take a long time to ameliorate. Finally, I'd like to say that I wish that we could be coming before you. I wish I could be at the table here with college management producing this bill. That would really be my desire. But that's not where we are. The colleges have resisted past attempts to deal with this problem, and they will most likely resist this one. They will promise to fix the problem on their own, but absent a requirement to do so, little, if nothing, will be done. In the meantime, students are suffering, departments are languishing, and the basic principle of equal pay for equal work is being subverted. It is time to fix this problem, and on behalf of the faculty in this state, I thank you for scheduling this hearing for us, and we'd all be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you so much. Gentlemen, I'm going to try to see if we can move without questions, unless it's a burning question. I'd like to get as much testimony in as possible. Given that, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Can I ask the administrator, do we have a fiscal on this yet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, no, we do not yet have a fiscal from Legislative Fiscal Office.
Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we please have Stephanie Blackman, Emily Plack, and David Reeves please come to the podium?
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Blackman, and next term I will teach 6 classes at 4 different campuses in Oregon, including PSU, Clackamas Community College, and 2 campuses of PCC. I have a dual master's degree in sociology and post-secondary adult education. In short, I'm good at my job, I absolutely love what I do, and there are many other teachers like me in our community colleges and universities. Yet because of the professional constraints of being a part-time faculty member, I can't be the educator I want to be. Today I'm here in support of the Faculty and College Excellence Act and to share with you some of the limitations of part-time teaching with respect to my students, the institutions I serve, and in my own personal life. As an educator, my primary concern is with students. So I work hard in class to promote learning. The effect of my part-time status outside of the classroom is where it has the biggest impact. I must limit my office hours in order to make my schedule work. I do not have enough time to offer students the kind of academic support, such as tutoring or research assistance, that furthers student success, or the personal support that students sometimes need in order to persist in college and that adds to the faculty-student relationship. Likewise, I have a hard time keeping track of the various testing, disability, tutoring, library, counseling, and advising services at each of the different campuses, and therefore admit to not doing as good a job as I would like to do in encouraging students to use those services. Furthermore, I believe in the process of faculty governance and the ability of faculty as citizens to create a learning environment that will serve the public good. I am willing to be on committees and councils and to serve that function, but I'm either not invited to the table or too busy flying down the freeways to the next campus to make it to the meeting. Consequently, I have little input in book selection, course outcome guides, departmental goals, or the administration of the university and community colleges for which I work. I also struggle to develop professional collegiality when I only see colleagues at the copy machine or mailboxes, if at all. To that end, part-time work comes with a host of mundane and academic inconsistencies. I have a different email address, office, phone extension, voicemail access number, copy machine code, copy center account, computer system login, and software ID, all with different password requirements at each school. I press 7 to erase messages at one campus and to save them at another. I use different textbooks for each course. I have access to different videos, teach in classrooms with different equipment, and have a key ring that would compete with any security guard or janitor. I work more than a full-time course load. I have no benefits. I pay my own health insurance. I drive 80 miles a day, wondering when it will be my turn for an accident. Each term, I have an intense period of stress, waiting to find out what classes will be offered to me and whether I can make the schedule work. Scheduling happens at different times for different schools, so this stressful period can last for weeks. While I am committed to education and to public service, I sometimes wonder if I could find more stability, security, and respect in the private sector. Oregon should not lose passionate teachers committed to helping our students prepare for productive work and active citizenship because its legislators lack the foresight to invest in education. I have been told on multiple occasions that my department wants to hire me, that I am exactly the right person for a full-time position, but that there is no budget to do so. I know that I do the best job that I can do right now, but I feel that I have so much more to give my students and the institutions that I serve. It is not right that a person teaching the same classes as a colleague, and sometimes more of them, does not receive the same package of pay and benefits. It does not make sense to have so many qualified professionals traveling between schools to patch together a full-time job. I urge the leaders of our state to provide opportunities for part-time faculty to move to full-time status and to create professional equity for the work we do. Please support the Faculty and College Excellence Act and know that by doing so, you are lifting the constraints of part-time work so that people like me can be the dedicated educators involved in our institutions of higher learning that we want to be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I do have to ask, decorum does dictate that we don't have expressions of applause or disapproval following testimony. If we could just have a respectful listening to each one of our guests, I would appreciate that.
Thank you. My name is Emily Fleck. I'm an associate professor of communication at Western Oregon University and vice president for membership of AFT Local 2278, the Western Oregon University Federation of Teachers. I'd first like to express my gratitude to Chair Buckley and to the members of the House Education Committee for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the Faculty and College Excellence Act. I come from teachers who come from farmers, who come from immigrants who believed in the promise of education. 5 years ago, when I came to Western Oregon University, I realized I was coming to a university at a time of state budget crises, post-Measure 5 struggles to meet increasing demands with decreasing resources, and a general malaise for the future of higher education in Oregon. I come before you today with an optimism I could not anticipate 5 years ago. Today I have hope. Today I hope that some of our highly qualified adjunct faculty members, teachers who have terminal degrees and tremendous talent, will find job security and move into tenure track lines at our institutions. I have hope that faculty members who already hold tenure track positions will no longer have to take summer jobs or engage in extensive consulting work outside of their university teaching in order to supplement meager incomes. I have hope that the best teachers, the ones who change students' lives, the ones who dedicate themselves to their work with unmatched passion will choose to stay at Oregon's universities because they are adequately compensated for their work. I did not have this hope 5 years ago when I began working at a vineyard in order to support my family through the summer and during a 2-year salary freeze. I did not have this hope when I sought to purchase my first home upon being awarded tenure and promotion, and realized with dismay that I had been priced out of the real estate market in the very same community in which I teach as a university professor. Think about it. This isn't New York City. It's not Silicon Valley. It's Monmouth, Oregon. This is the gap between the cost of living and the wages of working. In the absence of that hope, I had my wonderful colleagues, many of whom are here today, and my students, and they became the reasons for my retention. They are the reasons for retention of so many faculty across the Oregon University system. It was the students, it was their infectious hope that Oregon would come to her fiscal senses, reinvest in education, and move sure-footedly in the right directions that made me want to stay through that struggle. Because when you think about it, the struggle is for them. It's for the quality of their education, the attention they receive from their instructors, the value of their degrees from our institutions. The FACE Act ultimately is an investment in Oregon students, and I thank you for your consideration of it.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. My name is David Reeves. I have a MA in teaching English as a second language, and I've taught at Portland Community College for over 10 years now. When I first started teaching, I didn't think much of the limitations of the career. You know, I was eager to take on classes, develop in my profession, things like that. I didn't think about things like low pay, no benefits, total lack of job security. They don't really dawn on you until you're a little bit older, those kinds of things. Looking back, I don't know if I would make the same decision now to enter the field of teaching. In the decade that I've been at PCC, there have been two openings for a full-time instructor in ESL. Now there's finally a third one. You know, in a department with at least 60 adjunct teachers, you can imagine the competition there is for a position like this. So that's what I'm facing now. I teach 75% of a class load each term over 4 terms, including summer, over 4 terms a year. I teach as many credits in a year as a full-time teacher. I make half the pay for that. I can't attend all the meetings, participate in committees, things like that, because I have to take on other work, other teaching assignments to make an income. The lack of participation affects me and my department, particularly in terms of developing new curriculum, things to meet changing needs, changing workforce and such. Most importantly, it affects my students. I teach at a community college on a workforce training program. I don't teach the same young adults some of my colleagues do. I teach a lot of adults with low-level English skills. They've been in the workforce here for years. Now they're seeking new training as the workforce changes, as the workplace changes. They really do need extra help in returning to the classroom after all this time. Unfortunately, I can't be there to help them as much as if I were actually in a full-time position all week long at my department. And the sorry thing about this is that it's departments like mine, ESL, GED, Basic Academic Skills Preparation, these are the departments where you see the highest proportion of part-time teachers. So I was real excited when I heard about the FACE legislation, prorated pay and benefits, more full-time positions, things like this that I could really dedicate myself to my profession and my students. I really urge the members of the committee, Chair Buckley, to approve House Bill 2578, give Oregon students a first-class higher education. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you all three for your testimony. Thank you for your work. Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Jim Neway, Mark Schwebke, and Eli Herr, I believe, is the last one.
Mr. Chair, while the panel's gathering, I would like to put on the record that I'm an AFT retiree and was on the organizing committee for the part-time faculty at Portland.
Thank you for that conflict of interest.
Yeah, was that a conflict?
No. That was a proud declaration.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chairman Buckley, members of the committee. My name is Elijah Herr. I'm the student body president at PCC Cascade, and I'm your resident student voice today. So I agree with everything that's been said, and part-time faculty is challenging for students, and in some cases very detrimental. I want to relay a story of kind of how it plays out in practical terms. Two terms ago, I was taking a Spanish class at night from a woman named Vanessa Calderon. She was an educator in Spain, Barcelona, Spain, had moved to the United States, wanted to continue her chosen profession. After 6 months of looking for a job, a full-time job, she couldn't find one and took a job at a software company doing Spanish translation. She still loved the classroom, though, and decided that she was going to try and find a way to make it work. So she started teaching one nighttime section of Spanish at PCC while working a full-time job. The strain that put on her was so extensive that she couldn't continue to do it. Spanish is one of those classes that's sequenced. You take, you know, the first term, second term, third term. So after a single term, she had to quit. And, you know, there was a lot of students that were sad to see her go. When we asked her why, you know, she jokingly said, "I'd already worked my way through college once. I don't think that I need to do it again." But the fallout from that, what happened was the section wasn't replaced in time at that time schedule. Students who are managing jobs and family have very specific time slots in which they can actually take these classes. What ended up happening was I moved to a day class, but several of my colleagues were forced to go to another school with another textbook, with another teacher, and try and learn and patch together an education at another university or another community college. Very disruptive. Additionally, she was the head of a European club. Specifically, it was European Studies. And somehow she had managed to free up some time on Fridays to come in and chair this club and committee for students who are foreign exchange students, helping them kind of, you know, learn the city, learn where the resources were. It was a really cool club, you know, and kind of taking them on field trips to the library, things like that. That club disbanded. Those students, by the time we found a replacement at the very end of this term, those students had either moved on or were no longer interested and considered it to be not worth their time. You know, they'd already built a relationship with this advisor, and she couldn't do it. And I don't blame her. I think it's unfair, you know, and it's unfair to students. That's just one microcosm of what's playing out over and over and over again. And as we get more and more part-time faculty, we get more and more of these kinds of stories. I hear them all the time. I hear them from students all the time. It's not anecdotal. It really is what it's like. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's good to hear the student voice.
My name is Jim Niwe. I'm also a student, a graduate employee at Oregon State University. I'm working on my PhD in chemistry. And I'm also the president of CGE. That's the graduate employee local at Oregon State. We represent about 1,000 graduate students there. I'm here today to address the issue of fees that OSU students are charged every term. And these fees have been increasing every year, as most everything is, prices. And it's for that reason that I'd like to direct your attention to the language in paragraph 4, subsection 4 of House Bill 2578. And as I've said, this increase in fees is making OSU increasingly uncompetitive with peer institutions because potential graduate employees are choosing other institutions over us because these fees that OSU does not readily disclose are affecting who attends our university. And to give you an example of what these fees are, the minimum fees are $441 per term. There are four terms per year. As you can see, it adds up. Some of the graduate employees at Oregon State pay, it says, $1,100 per quarter per term. They're interchangeable. It's obviously a lot. If you break that down, if you add the mandatory fees, the salaries of some graduate employees becomes less than $7.80 per hour, which is less than the Oregon minimum wage. So, as I said, graduate employees are not often informed of this, and when they get their first stipend, they pretty much have to give all of that money back to the university because the fees are due at the beginning of the term on top of that. And as I said, this makes OSU uncompetitive, and when we can't recruit the best and brightest, so for me, if OSU doesn't have a reputation of being a world-class institution research-wise, that makes me less competitive when I finish to get a job. So that is what I have to say. Our peers at University of Oregon, graduate employees have the same concerns, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. On behalf of the nearly 12,000 members of the American Federation of Teachers in Oregon, I want to thank Chair Buckley and the committee for allowing testimony today on HB 2578. My name is Mark Schwepke. I'm president of AFT Oregon, and as an employee of Portland Community College for the past 17 years, I've had to watch as Measure 5 and reduced federal education dollars have choked off state and federal support for Oregon's community colleges and universities year by year, term by term, tuition hike by tuition hike, until community college tuition rates in Oregon are now three times what they are in California. And university salaries lag behind virtually every other Western state. Part-time faculty employees don't know from one term to the next whether they'll have a job or whether they'll be assigned courses and are rarely given adequate support to be successful. Student success rates have a direct correlation between students who interact with faculty and a collaborative learning atmosphere. Sadly to say, most part-time faculty lack office space or even paid time to be part of this interaction. One must ask, if the quality of education is negatively affected by these shortcomings, why administrators and politicians continue to pursue the status quo? Where is the inspiration or the will to grapple with these inequities here in Salem? Is it the aim of lawmakers here in Salem to be content with the Walmarting of higher education in Oregon? It would appear from the current budget being debated that not much has changed in regard to legislators caring about higher education with the same zeal as they do K-12 public education. HB 2578 is an attempt to reverse the slide by ensuring that all faculty members receive the financial and professional support they need to do their best work.
HB 2578 won't solve all of higher education's problems. However, it does establish a better balance between full-time tenured faculty and part-time adjunct and non-tenure track faculty in our colleges and universities. We ignore this at our collective peril. When those of my age are long gone from this earth, what we decide now about the future of our children's education will either raise us up or it's going to tear us down. We have it within our power to change. It's not rocket science. It's just a truly quality education that is an art that's nurtured by adherence to the ideas of excellent first and economic second. At some point, we must choose one or the other as the most important priority. I've been a business owner. I've been in the private sector. I know what the management of these colleges and faculty are going through. They don't have the money, you know. I know why all this stuff is happening with part-time faculty and all these percentages going up. There's the lack of support. It's pretty cut and dry. I mean, you know, if you're in the private sector, you run out your business plan, you have X amount of money for salaries and X amount of money for budget, and you go that route. And the way cheapest way you can get there, that's the way you go. Well, you know, public education is not the business of making widgets. It's providing quality education. There is a difference. I would entertain that it's a noble cause to emulate and swear by, if not by ourselves, then for the sake of our children. And remember, it's not about denigrating the adjunct and part-time faculty who work under increasingly difficult conditions. It's about making sure that faculty at Oregon's colleges and universities are given the resources necessary to do the job of educating Oregon students. It's that simple. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Olson.
Barry Edwards, Rosemary Teeter, and Lori Wimmer Whalen, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the 46,000 members of the Oregon Education Association who are both K-12 and community college faculty and classified workers. And I will be very brief because I'd rather you hear from my two members who are here to tell you about their experience as part-time faculty. But I did want to say for the record that we were, along with Michael Dembro, part of the part-time study that was referred to in the late 90s. As a matter of fact, after the legislature opted not to fund it, OEA helped to do so. And so it was a colossal disappointment not to get to the finish line with respect to getting great data for you as we moved forward with this issue so many years ago. And so I'm delighted to be here today to offer OEA's support for this bill, particularly the equity section. But with that, I'll hand over the mic to my colleagues. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Barry Edwards, and I am a Rhodes Scholar. I teach from Mount Hood Community College, teach math there part-time, and I also teach part-time at Portland Community College. I am been an advocate for part-time issues for over 10 years, currently a sitting board member on the Oregon Education Association representing community colleges. Whether you call us Rhodes Scholars or contingent faculty or part-time faculty, it's all pretty much the same. We all have the same kind of issues to deal with. We have typically 40 to 60% of the wages of a full-time faculty member on a per-class basis. Generally, we have little, if any, benefits, and job security is almost non-existent. But I'm going to focus, instead of on those issues particularly, I'm going to focus on how the bill affects our students. Now, admittedly, I did not become a community college instructor to get rich. I do this job because I want to give something back to the community, because I love my craft and I love my students. But the continuing abuse of the goodwill of part-time faculty in teaching our communities does honor to no one. Freeway Flyers Day is about teaching a class or two, then driving to the next college, teaching a class or two, perhaps driving to a third or a fourth college. I know colleagues that teach at four different schools. And, in fact, one term I did so myself. There's little time for helping students. There's little time for grading papers, little time for working on curriculum. We generally do that at home in the evenings. How is this fair to our students? And yet students pay the same tuition for a full-time faculty member as they do for a part-time faculty member. And I have to ask the question again, is this fair to our students? And one wonders how much attention that a part-time faculty member as myself can attend to taking care of those duties, teaching our students, when we're worried about paying the bills, when we're worried about health insurance and other kinds of issues like that. And I wonder again, how is this fair to our students? Well, the clear solution in my mind is House Bill 2578. I think this is the way that we need to go to help us head in the right direction to take care of this problem. Now, one can actually, you know, can reasonably say, how are we going to pay for this? That's a reasonable question to ask. Well, in my opinion, I think that we have an opportunity to give Oregon's business community a chance to step up to the plate and help pay for this. I think that since they have at least as much in stake in this issue as part-time community college faculty do, because they get the benefit of having those trained workers, then I think we can find a fair way to help them to step up to the plate and do this. I want to finish my testimony with a quote from Frank Brooks. He's a member of the Roosevelt Adjunct Faculty Organization, and he said, "Contingency is a threat to quality, not contingent faculty. It is not who we are, but how we are treated that undermines the quality of higher education." Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Rosemary Teeter. I live in Portland. I teach at Clackamas Community College and have for 6 years. I hold a master's degree in adult and continuing education. Classes I've taught include adult basic skills, GED preparation, values clarification, decision-making, note-taking, pre-college reading, and anything else they'll offer me. I became a teacher as a last resort. I had ended up through my life with long-time stints in medicine, in transportation, in travel and tourism, and in local government. And in every one of those situations, I ended up teaching people how to do things. And I finally succumbed to the teacher in me and went and got the credential I needed to do that job. My passion is teaching people how to go from where they are to where they want to go. And that's what I believe drives most part-time faculty, because it certainly isn't the pay and the benefits at this point in time. I'd like to just mention three quick vignettes. You have the longer versions in front of you. All of you run for election every 2 years. I run for election every term. I don't always know the votes until after my colleagues have been told what classes they'll have and I haven't been contacted. And that's reality every single solitary term. I will get paid on April 1st. On April 2nd, I hope to sign contracts for spring term work. And then I know I'll have paychecks in May and June and July. But not beyond July, because I don't know what summer will hold. And it usually doesn't hold the kind of opportunities that fall, winter, and spring terms hold. That's the reality for part-time faculty, and it doesn't matter how many colleges you juggle that reality at every one of them. Continuing to work as a contingent person is contingent on factors that I can't control. It doesn't matter how good I am, what qualifications I have. The decisions are beyond me. Many of us would apply for full-time jobs if they were available. When they become available, we do apply. And as someone mentioned earlier, there are 60 people in the department and one opening. Many of us have been doing this for many years, and we do it because of the passion we have for education. HB 2578, the FACE legislation, begins to provide some job security for people who currently don't have any. And we teach the majority of undergraduate classes in Oregon. There aren't a lot of potential college teachers in the pipeline right now. As the baby boomers retire, there are not going to be a lot of people coming along to do this work. Why should they under these conditions? Would you under these conditions? The second thing is health care benefits. Some people are able to pay for them out of their own pocket, or they have them through spouses or other employment. And many people do not have any benefits at all. Recently, I had bronchitis. It cost me $600 out of pocket. The only reason I was able to pay it is I had just gotten my tax return. But if I have bronchitis again sometime during the year, I'm out of luck, truly out of luck. That puts me up at OHSU unable to pay for it, which means the taxpayers ultimately pick it up. Taxpayers ultimately pick up part-time faculty being on Oregon Health Plan and food stamps. Food stamps are also a reality for us. That's not right. When the colleges have begun their strategic planning with the idea in mind that they can keep us at the wages and benefits levels that we're at now in order to balance their budgets, throwing the burden onto the community. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about what one of the students mentioned in terms of access. I'm one of the most visible people on campus. I've worked in one department for 10 years. And yet a student called in to find out how to contact me and was told I was hard to get a hold of because I'm part-time. And she was resourceful. She did get a hold of me. That's how I know about this story. I'm well enough known to consider myself notorious. And she was told I'm hard to get a hold of. If it's that way for me, how is it going to be for other part-time faculty people who don't have a physical space to sit? I didn't have a telephone that my phone number rang to for a long, long time. I only have one now because I hold union office. And it will go away when I no longer hold that office. No wonder students can't get a hold of us. We're ephemeral. That needs to change. The FACE legislation makes makes a start at changing that. And finally, I just want to say that for all of us who teach, we teach from our hearts because it's what we love to do. We hope that you'll support the people we teach, who are the economic drivers of the economy in the state of Oregon, by making it possible for us to do our jobs to the fullest professional degree. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being here. Thank you for your work. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor George Perlsteiner, please. Okay, since he has stepped out, we can call him up a little bit later. Can we please have the Community College Association panels come forward, as many as can fit at once? Rick Levine, John Turner.
His chancellor.
Oh. All right. We'll go with it.
Is it okay with you, gentlemen, the chancellor go first? Welcome, Mr. Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. For the record, George Perlsteiner, I bring you greetings from the overflow room. This is an important bill and a very prominent one. For the record, George Perlsteiner, Chancellor of Oregon University System. Where do I begin? This bill does a lot of things that I think are very important. This bill says we should pay our faculty what they're worth. And we should pay our faculty the kind of money it would take to attract and retain top-notch, world-class teachers and researchers. This bill also says that we should have more of those faculty be full-time. That we should have more opportunity then for students to be mentored, advised, guided, and assisted by full-time faculty. These are the same goals which our board enunciated last year when it put forward its budget proposal to the governor. These are, in fact, the kinds of things that Oregon should be striving to achieve for its future and the future of its students and citizens. So I agree with almost every recital in this bill. So why do I oppose it? You've heard some of the reasons already on the reverse side. This bill is proposed to you because over the last 15 years, the state has been unable to invest in higher education. at a time when the demand and need for higher education has increased phenomenally in our state, in our society. And so the response of the community colleges and the response of the universities has been to try to enroll as many students as we could and to provide them with quality instruction in order to help them meet the challenges of the 21st century. But we've had to do it without the use of as many tenured and tenure-track faculty as we would have liked. We are, as the university system, running about one-third of our classes now, or one-third of our credits, really, with non-tenure or tenure-track faculty. Admittedly, that's not quite as low as the national average, which was cited to you earlier, but it is certainly a lot lower than we used to be, and certainly a lot lower than we would strive to be. But the fiscal impact of this bill, which is being prepared now, is likely to be substantial. As you know, the board proposed a 10-year phase-in of bringing our faculty salaries to competitive rates, and a 10-year phase-in of bringing the student-faculty ratios to competitive ratios. The budget that the governor proposed brought us part of the way towards the board's goal in that first biennium. However, we are still not certain that even that amount of money will be appropriated by this body. It would be a very unfortunate thing for me to say that we would embrace this bill without receiving from the state the level of investment it would take to achieve it. So that's number one. Number two, the bill, perhaps without intending it, is an automatic restriction on enrollment. Why do I say that? I say that because you have to have, department by department, enough tenured or tenure-track faculty on staff to meet the likely and possible surge demands of enrollment, department by department, or you cannot offer the class. Essentially, what that means is you cannot do, as many of our institutions have done, you cannot surge in certain disciplines to meet the demands of students as they arise, because you would not have enough tenured or tenure-track faculty on hand in those departments at that time. I think that could well be an unintended consequence, but it can have a big impact on many of our institutions, and I'm aware of how Portland State grew in the late 1990s, and many of the disciplines that grew would not have been able to grow under this bill. Subsequently, in many of those departments, tenured and tenure-track faculty were hired. But at the time that the first enrollment surge occurred, they were not there. There would be a significant amount of administrative cost to track the various things that this bill calls for us to track. Part of it is to track to make sure that we have the right number of faculty for the courses being offered and the enrollment as it happens. But the other thing is, it requires us to track across all 24 institutions of public higher education in the state the various employment arrangements of every single person, because when they trip over a certain number of cumulative hours, they become eligible for benefits, regardless of where they are. Now, we could certainly do that a little better within the university system among our 7 campuses, because we have a single kind of software for the payroll. But the 17 community colleges and we collectively do not have the same kinds of systems and don't have anything in place right now that would allow us to make that kind of tracking. To say nothing of the costs that would be involved in actually paying the benefits. I'm not arguing that point. I'm arguing the point of how would we do it economically and adequately. There is one other thing that I think is of concern, or would be, to some of the faculty in some of the departments. And that is because this bill gives preference to our very capable adjunct and other part-time faculty for hiring into full-time positions when they become available. Now you say, well, that's a no-brainer. Well, no, it's not. It's not because for the last 125 years, as the United States has built the best higher education system in the world, we have built it by building our faculties. With the faculties among themselves within departments choosing who their colleagues would be in order to fill in the gaps that they may have in their discipline focus areas, in an attempt then to build a set of colleagues. I'm not saying that our very capable and very admirable adjunct and part-time faculty would not be competitive for those jobs. I'm not saying that at all. They probably would be. But to say in the bill that they will be given preference flies in the face of the kinds of selection processes which faculty historically have enjoyed. And I think before we go there, we ought to think about the implications of that. In summary, I'm concerned about the cost. I'm concerned about the administrative burden. I'm concerned about the changes in the way that faculty are hired that may flow from the bill. And I'm concerned about the possibly unintended consequence of holding down enrollment when that is, I don't think, in the interest of either the state or the students. I agree with the very admirable goals of having a greater number of faculty and having them be able to spend a greater amount of time with the students and paying them adequately. I just don't think this particular bill is the way to do that. But it does have one, perhaps positive, unintended consequence. And my students will tell you that probably today, because I put in grades yesterday. It would get me out of the classroom. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor. Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you for your patience and consideration. I appreciate it.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Levine, and I represent the Oregon Community College Association and the 17 colleges that are part of that association and the 350,000 students who attend our colleges. We are here today in opposition to the bill, and I probably could just echo all the comments that the Chancellor made and give my testimony over quickly. I do have with me three presidents, a vice president, to talk about several different issues as they see it from their college perspective, and at least one president who has gone through the California version, a little bit different version of this bill, and can talk to you a little bit about that. Let me just make a couple of comments off of the handout I gave you. When we talk about the cost of implementing a bill like this, it's rather difficult. I think Steve Bender, legislative fiscal office, will tell you that it's been very difficult to wrap his arms around what this amount will be. But our office took a quick stab at it with information from the colleges, and at a minimum, at full implementation, it's about a $50 million cost to college districts. At the top end, it might be twice that, at $100 million. Now, if you took that number and put it into the bill that talks about setting aside a fund of money in which the interest would be used to fund this particular bill, you would see about $1 billion to $2 billion price tag to make this happen. Obviously, that's not all at once, but eventually you'd be setting aside a corpus large enough to fund community colleges four times over at our current rate. Another issue for us, and it's been mentioned all the way through the testimony, is that our budget, as presented by the governor, barely got us back to the 2001 level, which is we call the status quo budget. We've, as many of you know, and I've testified in front of you, we were asking for $529 million that provides us with some growth. That would not make this bill happen as well. There just not that kind of money in the system to move this bill in the way folks would like to have it move. I would be remiss if I didn't point out an article that appeared in the Oregonian this morning. It was a study done by the Oregon Student Association, in which the primary complaint students had was that they are not able to complete their coursework in an appropriate amount of time. They stated, in fact, that the number of sections that have been offered over the last 4 or 5 years have been reduced, and 25% to 35%, depending on which program they're in, have been forced to continue their education much longer than they anticipated and incur additional debt. Most of that comes from the defunding of community colleges over the last four bienniums. And that needs to change if we are to be able to get our students out in a timely manner to make a difference in Oregon's economy. It also has an effect on this bill, and obviously that the more full-timers you have, as the Chancellor mentioned, the fewer sections are going to be offered by part-timers. It means that college offers fewer and fewer sections, means that fewer and fewer students can access a higher education. I'll conclude my testimony with an introduction of Jim Middleton from Central Oregon Community College, who will discuss some of the California issues that arose with a bill similar to this.
Chair Buckley, Jim Middleton for the record. For the record, I'm Jim Middleton, president of Central Oregon Community College. As a side note, we have one of the highest proportions of full-time faculty in the state. We do pay prorated benefits for faculty who teach at least a half-time load. In many ways, as Mr. Pernsteiner stated, I agree strongly with many of the points made by my faculty colleagues. They pointed out that nationally, we have made significant cuts in our commitment to higher education in this country, and sadly, the cuts in Oregon have been steeper. To survive, our colleges and universities have been forced, not chosen, to move to a greater reliance on part-time staff. Unfortunately, the saddest point about this testimony is that where we get put in a position is the unacceptable situation of pitting higher education against K-12, community colleges against the universities, and boards and administration against faculty. That result is unacceptable. In the 60s, Oregon was the shining beacon of what can and should be done for higher education. We funded at a level significantly higher than the national average. And just an hour or so ago, we were sharing information among ourselves. We are rapidly fighting our way to the bottom. We provide only 38% of the state funding per capita as the state of New Mexico, which is leading the field. As noted, I spent 10 years as president at a California community college in a system that did have a 75-25 mandate. Again, the college I was at had one of the highest proportions of full-time faculty and did pay prorated benefits to our staff. But I also experienced myself the realities of trying to live within this and saw what happened with 107 other CEOs trying to deal with the mandate. In fact, what happened to try to meet a 75-25? Literally, part-time classes were cut to try to get within a percentage. When colleges did not have the funds to add additional full-time positions, the only way to improve your position on the percentage was to cut out part-time faculty classes. Students in the community suffered. An unintended consequence was that there are many critical elements of our institutional mission that fall outside the calculation. Librarians don't count. Librarian positions were cut. Counselors don't count. Counselors were cut or eliminated. Tutors don't cut. count, excuse me, online services, equipment, clerical support for faculty, all of those did not count. And when push came to shove, and there were literally financial consequences, institutions cut those services to the detriment of students to fit a mandate. There are other particulars here that Chancellor Pernsteiner pointed out are huge implementation hurdles. It applies to departments with 8 or more staff in the department. Many of the community colleges are small enough that we would have about 7.5 full-time equivalent faculty in a department. This mandate would be huge pressure never to expand that department because of the trigger it would then put as far as a cost issue. There would be huge bureaucratic staff and legal time, unfortunately, spent on what is a department. When the trigger is 8 full-time faculty, is it the liberal arts department? Is it the social sciences department? Is it the anthropology department, or is it the cultural anthropology department? Is it the career and technical department, the mechanical and building trades? Is it auto body, or is it auto? The way each one of those questions would be answered would significantly impact how many faculty are in a department. What do we do with faculty who are on sabbatical? What do we do with should we be punished by bringing in part-timers to provide a full-time or release time to deal with curriculum development, coordination with high schools, governance committees? And how do you deal with teaching at multiple sites? Do you require full-time faculty to move across a district such as mine that covers 10,000 square miles? Or do you use part-time faculty closer to the site of where some of those would be? There are many well-intentioned items here. And I agree with many of the points that were made. I do believe, though, that if we would bring this state's commitment to higher education back to the level that was an example for the nation, you would see significant change in what our percentages were. To put a mandate in place before we make that commitment is clearly not implementable and would not be in the best interest of expanding services to students. Sadly so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. I'm John Turner. I'm the president of Blue Mountain Community College and appeared before the committee a couple of weeks ago. Blue Mountain Community College serves the 6 northeast counties of Oregon, about 18,000 square miles. Only about 145,000 people up there, so that's about 7.8 people per square mile. It's a very rural area. I have offices that are well over 2 hours apart in driving time. So I want to say that just to set the context, as I thought, how would I implement this bill if it were to pass in its current form? The first thing that would happen is many of these smaller facilities are almost entirely served by part-time instructors because it's hard to find out there in these little towns, Enterprise, John Day, Baker City, enough students to put together that want to take a class at one time. Usually it's about 8 to 12 people. I couldn't keep a full-time instructor busy in, say, math or social science or humanities in one of these smaller facilities. Consequently, if I had to maintain this level of instruction with full-timers, the practical impact is that face-to-face instruction in 5 of the 6 counties that I serve would virtually go away. I might be able to keep some kind of office open with computers for distance ed or something like that, but face-to-face instruction is going to disappear in all but one county, Umatilla County. GED programs and adult basic ed that are vitally important to these small rural communities would also go away. Unless it was done somehow online, but it wouldn't be face-to-face the way we do it right now. If I were the county commissioners in some of these counties, I would start to wonder what was the purpose of my contributing my property tax to Blue Mountain Community College if I wasn't getting face-to-face instruction. I think if I were county commissioner, I would have to seriously start considering leaving the taxing district, which puts more pressure on the public budget to fund higher ed in the state. You might ask, well, why couldn't you use some of your 25% part-timers to deliver instruction out at those places? And the reason is because in Umatilla County, at Pendleton and Hermiston, where the bulk of my students are, I would have to use that other 25% to keep certain programs going. Yes, I run my nursing program with full-time nursing instructors, but all my clinicals are taught, or not all of them, but vast majority of them are taught by part-timers that work out there in the hospitals. My small enrollment programs, such as criminal justice, physics, early childhood ed, those are all run by highly qualified part-time instructors who are experts in their field. Those would have, if I was going to keep those, I couldn't have instruction, face-to-face instruction in some of the small rural communities that I serve. Travel costs would have to be factored in somehow. I think even for a school size of mine, I think you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in increased travel costs. The issue of quality has been talked about quite a bit. At BMCC, we take student surveys every term. I had my institutional researcher run the numbers for the last 2 years, and there's virtually no difference in student attitudes towards part-timers and full-timers. And that's not really the issue in this bill, but what I want to say is that I have some very highly qualified part-time instructors that really have the ability to inspire their students just as much as full-timers do. The issue that Chancellor Pernsteiner talked about in hiring and having some sort of provision for preferential hiring of part-timers flies in the face of running a full-time search nationally to try and attract the very best and the brightest. If we can only have so many full-time instructors, and right now that's all we can have is so many, we probably should try to pick the very best ones, not just the ones that have lived locally and been teaching for us. Some of them will get hired from the local pool, but I'd like to have the opportunity to look nationwide and hire the very best and the brightest that come to interview. We've already talked about cost of instruction. If we were to try to fund this and offer the current number of sections at Blue Mountain Community College that I offer now, I think the increased cost to college would be several million dollars a year. If this bill were not funded properly, then I would have to cut literally hundreds of sections each year. We made an estimate that we might have to cut as many as 1,000 sections over a year. The problem with that is that the financial profit that's made from those sections is what keeps my college alive. And so an unintended consequence of this bill might be, by cutting all those sections, you could very well send the entire institution into financial tailspin. So I just think that before we look at mandates and all the provisions of the bill, we probably should look at unintended consequences of the bill, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Goulard, and I serve as Chemeketa Community College's Vice President and Chief Academic Officer. And in that role, I'm charged, among other things, of being a thoughtful steward of the precious instructional dollars that I do have to invest on behalf of our district and to forward us toward our strategic intent. And we, as a college, have three main thrusts. One is to promote adult literacy, very, very important role. If we don't do it, nobody will. The second is to open the door to all levels of college, and that access issue has been discussed and referenced here in a number of ways today. And the third is to build instructional centers of excellence. And I have to say that during the past 6 years as chief academic officer at Chemeketa, that has been a tremendous struggle, because I've witnessed the worst disinvestment of public funding for higher education in community colleges history in Oregon. Just to illustrate that a little bit for you, our institution has faced annual budget deficits. The first deficit was a $9 million gap. That was on a little over a $50 million general fund budget. That was in 2003-04, followed the very next year after budget cuts by a $7.8 million gap, followed by a $5.2 million gap. With the proposed co-chair's budget for 2007-08, we now face the need to bridge yet another multi-million dollar gap should that budget move forward. In previous budget years, we've reduced our administrative staffing by 18.3%, our faculty ranks by 9.5%, and classified support by 8.9% to balance those budgets. community college state revenue as proposed by the co-chair's budget and characterized in constant dollars is 8% less than what was distributed to us in 1999-2001 biennium. Now, weigh that against the cost of House Bill 2578, which is projected for Chemeketa to be $8.3 million per year. That's on a $53 million general fund budget. It's not that I don't support, you know, many of the concepts, but how can we possibly address that additional cost when we can't today afford the cost of our rollover budget? I'm carefully trying to build back faculty and program investments with creative funding streams, partnerships, grants, contracts, and alternative ideas. But the challenge we have here is this is another mandate which would require a tremendous cost and would create no new access for the students of our state, even if the state does fund it. I want to give you a few other illustrations of the magnitude of what the legislation proposes. Assuming the co-chair's budget and the passage of this legislation, we would need to raise, this is an equivalency, we'd need to raise tuition an additional $40 per credit hour to bridge the budget gap. That's a 62.5% increase if we wanted to hold offerings the same. What might happen if we choose not to increase tuition and instead reduced other expenditures to fund the legislation? We'd have to close every outreach campus that we operate in Woodburn, McMinnville, Dallas, Santiam, Downtown Training and Economic Development Center, our Northwest Viticulture Center. If we only operated from the Salem campus, we still wouldn't have enough revenue to finance the annual costs of this legislation. If we eliminated every course section taught by adjunct faculty and closed our entire online program, serving tens of thousands of students a year, we would still not have enough revenue to afford this legislation. If we closed our nursing, emergency medical technology, automotive, early childhood education, electronics, manufacturing, and computer science programs, we still would not have enough revenue to afford this legislation. If I shut down every single student service that Chemeketa offers and close the student services budget, we would still not have enough revenue to afford the legislation, just to give you a sense of the scope of what this bill discusses. There have been other comments made by speakers. My written testimony references the impacts on local control and just the notion that our local college board can work through collective bargaining to address issues relating to quality of instruction, hiring of faculty, methods of assignment, and staffing of classes. And there are comments in my written testimony about the tracking systems, the priority considerations for teaching, the preferential considerations for appointments, the pro rata salary standard. Our flexibility of class offerings would be diminished because we now offer day and evening, weekday and weekend, online and on-site, multi-site courses, and so that is unable to be done without a significant number of part-time faculty as well. In summary, I think I'll just say that the legislation, I believe, is bad public policy for three reasons. It's the additional financial burden, either for the state or for local institutions to bear during an era when we have precious few available resources for baseline programming that we offer today. Second, it would take away the authority of our local community college boards and the legitimacy of the collective bargaining process to determine how best to invest those precious resources to support instruction and student access. And third, it would have a detrimental effect on the employment of our current highly valued adjunct faculty. There would certainly be fewer of them. And with that, I thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. Thank you all three. Oh, your turn, sir.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, my name is Greg Heyman, and I'm president of Clatsop Community College. We are a small, comprehensive community college that serves the northwest corner of this state. I thank you for the opportunity to talk about some issues related to House Bill 2578. First, I'd like to state that we value very highly the complementary but different roles that full-time and part-time faculty play at our institution. The challenge of a small, comprehensive institution is that We work to provide curricular depth and breadth, and to do it within a way that creates the greatest access for our students. And we recognize that in order to do that, we need the flexibility in utilizing the expertise and the capacity of those very two important resources in our organization, again, full-time and part-time. And a number of people have made the point that this isn't really a conversation about instructional quality, but I would like to quote from a 2005 publication entitled Adjunct Faculty and Community Colleges, in which, and this is a quote, it's from page 6 if you want to make note, many studies have found that students learn as much in classes of part-time faculty as are likely and are as likely to be retained as students taught by full-time faculty. They have no more discipline problems. Their students' evaluations and grades they give to students are comparable to those of full-time instructors. That is what is found at the national level, is certainly what we find at Clatsop Community College. We value the instructional quality that both our full-time and our part-time faculty play in. And again, we use them in a very dynamic way in order to provide, I think, something that we all agree on, and that is access to quality education for our students. I'd like to give you three examples of where that's important to us and specific programs for us. Criminal justice is one of them. It's a program that is built around a core full-time faculty, a woman who has her Juris Doctorate and is able to provide expertise in a very strong area within the criminal justice discipline. But our students benefit from also receiving courses from our Chief of Police, from a variety of people, the district attorney, who hold positions in our community, who are able to give a depth and a breadth to that education that one full-time faculty person is not able to give. Our art program, which we are so very proud of, is built around two full-time faculty, one in ceramics and one in two-dimensional art, drawing and painting. And yet we feel that our students benefit from quality instruction in sculpture and in printmaking that we could not do if we were limited to the 25-75 ratios that are prescribed in this bill. Another one that that we're certainly cognizant of is the social sciences area. And again, Dr. Middleton has mentioned that just defining what a department is or a program is an interesting exercise. And but let's assume that we have a social sciences department or program. We're able to build that program around full-time faculty who teach in sociology and psychology, but we frequently find that our students would like to take an anthropology class, or perhaps a geography class, or perhaps a course in European history. And in order to provide that breadth within that program, we rely on the expertise of part-time faculty, which are integral to the depth and the quality of the program that we're able to provide. And to mandate specific ratios would jeopardize our ability to do that. In fact, if we were to move to the 75-25 that's prescribed in this bill, we would be required, and assuming there are not additional resources, it would require us to shift resources in such from part-time to full-time instruction in such a way that we would reduce our instructional capacity by 243 classes per year. It would result in a reduced service to students of around 200 FTE. Now, that may not sound like a lot to you, but we are a 1,400 FTE institution. It's a significant impact on us, and it's a significant impact on our ability to serve the people in our community. We would also offer fewer professional technical education classes. We believe about 40 fewer classes per year. We may have to eliminate even whole programs that are taught predominantly or exclusively by part-time faculty, such as early childhood education, which is a huge need in our community, but we would not be able to sustain that program. I guess I'd wrap it up by simply saying the implementation of this bill at our institution would result in fewer classes, fewer students served, and a reduced breadth and depth in the programs that we're able to offer, and we don't believe that that's in the best interest of our students. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being here today. Also, we did have that one person is from.
Peter Cayero, Doug Crow, Brian Deedle, please.
Thank you. I guess I will go first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much, and I promise to be the very first person to stay within your 2 minutes.
Thank you.
My name is Peter Calero. I live here in Salem, House District 21, Representative Clem's district, and I'm speaking in support of House Bill 2578. Two perspectives I want to offer, one as a parent, one as a professor. My two oldest children are graduates of the University of Oregon. My two youngest are currently enrolled at the University of Oregon. And I'm a professor of sociology at Western Oregon University, and I have been for over 20 years. Last year at this time, my colleagues and I were literally within hours of the first strike of higher ed faculty in the history of the state of Oregon. Faculty at Eastern Oregon University also voted to authorize a strike. Less than a year ago. You all know about the crisis, especially you, Representative Buckley, at Southern Oregon University. This bill is an important first step to address some of these structural issues. The faculty have a can-do attitude. Sometimes we feel like our administrators have a can't-do attitude, and we're willing, hopefully, to work to bring an end to this crisis that we're facing. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Brian Nittell. I am a teaching assistant at Oregon State University. I have a master's degree in mathematics and a bachelor's degree in mathematics and physics. I support House Bill 2578, and in particular, subsection 4 of section 4, which offers fee relief for graduate employees. I'd point out that no one has raised any objections to that section. So,
so noted.
Over the past several years, fees have exploded at Oregon State University. One of the main reasons for this is because it's very difficult to raise tuition by large amounts. It's substantially easier to create new fees and raise existing fees. As a result, graduate employees at Oregon State University are being paid less and less every year. Our salaries stay the same, fees increase. Currently at Oregon State University, the salaries and benefits of graduate employees are among the lowest in the nation. Some graduate employees at Oregon State University are making below minimum wage after fees are factored in. I spent some time last night on the internet trying to find somewhere that offered teaching assistantships in mathematics that were lower than mine. I couldn't find a single university. The closest one was Boise State University, which offered $500 more per year in addition to a fee waiver and full health insurance. I know that resources are limited and that this money is not going to come out of nowhere. You're either going to have to raise taxes or take it from someone else. That's the very nature of this. However, more and more courses are taught by graduate teaching assistants, while fewer and fewer are taught by professors and instructors. We are among the lowest paid graduate employees in the nation, and we're making less every year because of fees. Even if this bill passes, we'll still be among the lowest paid in the nation. However, we know our salaries won't decrease every year because we're forced to pay these fees. I'm not asking for a raise, although that would be very nice. I only want you to ensure that every year graduate employees in Oregon can take home the same amount of pay for the same amount of work every year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, my name is Doug Crow. I'm an adjunct faculty in the Portland State University Business School. I've been a professor there, adjunct, for about 12 years. And I never thought I'd be sitting here. I never thought as a business person I would become a member of a union. But last summer, in some frustration, I became a member of the Portland State Union. Because I have observed these inequities, these problems, and I support this bill because I feel like there's a huge need for reform and revitalization of the system. And I'm very disappointed when I hear the kind of doomsday scenarios that certain administrators bring to you when they should really be, as the committee is doing and as the legislature is forced to do, take a more positive approach to figure out how we can get back to what I experienced in the 60s at Oregon State University, where I'm a graduate, of a really first-rate system. And I hesitate to use the words world-class or national, because I think we have so far to go that those are almost meaningless at this point. I support the bill, and there's one additional area that I think needs work. I understand that you've got the legislative fiscal office working on an analysis, but from my observation as a securities analyst, as a business professor, I think that there's an enormous need for transparency. We've heard this across business, especially since the internet debacle and the crises in corporate America, and I think there's a crisis here in the system of higher education. I know as a faculty member, I have great difficulty in trying to even develop some comparisons between what adjuncts are paid in my department, other departments, other universities. I think there's no consistency of reporting, and I think there needs to be a real effort to develop some transparency so the administrators, the legislators, the people who are trying to manage these important resources can do so. And I would encourage you to support a better effort in accounting and understanding exactly how this operates. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Cobb, we have nine more people to testify.
That's
we have nine
really
minutes.
Quick question, I swear. Are we referring to the student incidental fee when you're...
There are multiple fees that have been created. There's a student incidental fee, technology fees, building fees, resource fees, health center fees, psychological service fees.
So when this bill says student fees, you mean
covers
all of them?
This covers all of them.
Okay.
That's all I got. Thank you very much. Thank you for testimony. Thank you for being here. Mr. Olson.
Janice Bishop, Laura Robbins, Elizabeth Cole, please.
Welcome. Thank you for being here.
I'm Janice Bishop. Thank you, Chair Buckley, and thank you, members, for hearing us out today. I am an adjunct instructor at Portland State University, Clackamas Community College, Temecula Community College, Merrillhurst University, Portland Community College, Kaplan University, University of Phoenix, and I've also taught at Warner Pacific. So there's a wide range of public and private institutions there. I'm going to depart from my comments only because you asked us to be brief and to reflect on what had been said before so that we're not repeating information. And two main arguments that I hear is from the standpoint of my own personal representation here is I'm coming as a voice of an adjunct, obviously, and my interest is in equal pay for equal work. And I hear arguments such as the hardship of the adjunct. Well, we all have hardships in our jobs. Nobody forces us to do the work that we do. We try to do what we love, and if we can find a forum to do it, we do it, and we willingly take on those hardships. The other argument that I hear is affordability, cost. Where is the money going to come from? But what I'm hearing is a banter of euphemisms. What it really comes down to is exploitation. Adjuncts are being exploited, and this needs to end. It's not about whether or not we can afford to end it. It's not about whether or not it's time to end it. It's about it needs to end, and it needs to end with this bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Elizabeth Cole, and I'm an adjunct instructor at Portland Community College and Portland State University. I teach in the Intensive English Language program at PSU and the ESOL program at PCC. And I'm just here to support this bill. Sometimes I end up working 12 or 13 hour days. I oftentimes don't have time to eat dinner except grab a piece of pizza en route from one place to another. And as this colleague has said, it is about exploitation, and that's why I'm here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Laura Robbins. Thank you, Chair Buckley and committee members. Thank you for giving us this time. Everybody loves part-time faculty. I'm a part-time faculty. I've taught for 9 years at Mount Hood Community College, for 2 years and 7 years at Portland Community College. I know they love me because at 5 years they gave me a pin. And while I was driving home, I opened the window and chucked it off the Markham Bridge. I hope that that didn't hurt any salmon. I realize it was a little rash. But everybody's talking about, and I hear this from the school administration, and I didn't come as an adjunct and think that I would be in conflict with my own administration. I thought we were all kind of doing the same thing. And so as I was hired as a young, kind of wide-eyed graduate and happy to work for low money and no benefits while I'm young, and now 9 years later I'm less young, and I'm still doing the same thing and in the same position. And it isn't because I want it, it's because there are no options. And people love you, people appreciate you, but they still continue to exploit you. This still happens. They make arguments I've heard today about the ratio of part-time and relying on part-time faculty and how good part-time faculty are. I know that. I see it in my colleagues. I know the way I prepare for my classes. In our department, over half the course offerings and composition are taught by part-time. So it's not a small percentage. It's the larger percentage. And these group of people don't have any options. And I don't hear anybody providing any kind of explanation for why our pay is not at least equal at this point. If even if the ratios aren't going to be 75-25, what is the rationale for no health care? What is the rationale for unequal pay? At what point do you stop supporting a system that has created a rank of second-class citizens? And I can tell you that this plays out socially in the department as well and creates problems for people. I also know that just last week, I'm going to start teaching on Monday, but I don't know what courses exactly I'm going to be teaching. The reason is because they have to wait and watch the enrollment and keep me in limbo to see where they're going to put me, because they're not going to run a class unless it's full enough. So I'm going to have about 48 hours to prepare professionally for my class. This is not unusual for me as an adjunct. It happens once or twice a term. Sometimes a course gets dropped, my pay gets immediately cut in half. I have a 48-hour notice on that. That is an acceptable practice. If I ask why that happens, someone tells me it's budget and shrugs their shoulders. I don't know why that's allowed to continue. I love to teach. I love my students. Please allow me to continue to do this without feeling like I'm in some kind of indentured servitude.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your testimony, for your work. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nora Stevens, Jesse Buffton, and Kelly Cowan, please.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, thanks for giving us the opportunity to come here and talk about House Bill 2578. My name is Jesse Buffton. I'm from Portland State University. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Student Association, representing over 100,000 students from across the state of Oregon, from community colleges as well as universities. I'm going to be brief because I have written testimony, but there are a couple things I wanted to talk about and touch on quickly and just give you more of the student experience in this issue. So as a result of our state's decision to disinvest in higher education over the past decade or so, universities have been forced to use more part-time adjunct faculty to cover the load. Well, why is this a problem? I can tell you from the student experience. There was some talk before about faculty, part-time faculty, and in-class experience versus full-time faculty. I can tell you as a student, part-time faculty often do a great job in the classroom, and as a student, that's not where my concern is. My concern is as a student, we're feeling the impact outside the classroom. We rely on professors outside the classroom for help with extra tutoring, a lot of research experience, these types of things. And that is where this is having its biggest impact. I can give you really quickly a personal story of mine. Last term I had a professor who taught at the University of Oregon and Portland State University. This amazing professor would commute from Eugene up to Portland once a week for this class, and it was acknowledged by him the lack of resources that he had for outside classroom for students. So that's just a story with you there. Faculty know it, and the students know it. And then the second thing I wanted to talk to you about was the issue of fees that this bill talks about, and specifically programmatic resource fees. Another result of the disinvestment in higher education from the state has been passing the burden on the students through extra programmatic resource fees. I just want to make the point that these fees are assessed outside of tuition and financial aid, meaning that it's an extra cost that no one has thought about on the student's end, or really the school's end in the financial aid sense. It's an extra barrier to education. Specifically for a lot of graduate students who are helping in undergrad classes, these students, as well as faculty who are taking classes, are also assessed these fees. Even though there's a tuition waiver, like I said before, it's outside of the tuition and financial aid. So thank you for allowing me time to testify.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I'm next.
Go for it.
Good afternoon, Chairman Buckley, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Cowan, and I teach marketing research and basic marketing at Portland State, and I'm also a PhD student there. I'm studying the marketing of technology, so I know a little bit about being both a student as well as a part-time instructor. And if some of the comments that I'm hearing today from some of my colleagues are correct, I guess you could say that I'm potentially becoming an aspiring Rhodes Scholar. I hope that with the passage of this act that I might be able to someday become a full-time tenured professor, and I hope that concept still exists by the time I graduate and it's able to do me some good. I don't want to repeat what other speakers have said, and I did submit written testimony, so you can look at that in detail. What I would like to do is offer a little bit of an outside perspective. I moved here last year from New Mexico. I heard some people mention New Mexico, and I wanted to offer a couple of observations about that. When I first moved here, I was actually classified as a graduate assistant because I hadn't... when I arrived in the fall, I didn't yet have my adjunct position. And I was surprised to find that I actually made less as a graduate assistant here, about half of what I made at the University of New Mexico, where I got my master's degree. I was somewhat surprised at that because for people who aren't familiar with New Mexico, it's not a wealthy state. In fact, it generally ranks among one of the lowest per capita states in terms of income, as well as one of the lowest per capita in terms of spending on many education measures, certainly primary education. So as I'm hearing people describe the various difficulties in coming up with money to pay for this bill, it just strikes me that it's not so much an issue that a state like New Mexico has more revenue. It's just an issue that they have different priorities. And I certainly hope that we can establish similar priorities here. I would just like to briefly wrap up by describing my role as an adjunct instructor. After I became an adjunct and no longer a graduate assistant, I did expect the rate to be much higher because I'm a PhD student and I have a number of years of experience. But I actually found that the amount I was paid was not considerably higher, and as evidence of this, I've actually attached a little table that compares rates as a PSU graduate assistant, my rate as a graduate assistant at the University of New Mexico, as well as PSU adjunct instructors, and OSU. I understand from the testimony of the other speaker that their fees may be higher than ours, but it looks like they do maybe a little bit better in terms of their graduate assistant pay. Anyway, I wanted to propose perhaps a provocative question to wrap up. I wanted to say that in listening to all the university administrators describe the various classes that would have to be cut in order to meet the requirements of this bill, and listening to them describe campuses that may have to be closed, there were two things I never did hear. I never heard them describe how much money they'd have to cut from the sports team, and I never heard them describe how much money they'd have to cut from administrator salaries. And I would propose that if they examined those issues, they may in fact find that they could afford to pay teachers enough so they could make the classes interesting and students would want to stay here. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi. My name is Nora Stevens. I teach part-time at Portland Community College in biology. And I just basically want to reiterate the some of the things we've heard at very short length about having to find my own health insurance to the tune of 10% of what I make. That the instability is very difficult, not having the idea up to, you know, a couple of days in advance whether something a class to which I have committed is now not going to be committed to me, basically. And that this it's a full-time work for part-time pay kind of situation. And unfortunately, I am a good teacher. I'm dedicated. I've got a lot of education. My students really like what I'm doing. I ask a lot of them. And yet I'm forced to consider other options to go into another career. And I really don't like that. I have not been pushed that far yet. I have the luck to be supported at home by a spouse who can help with that. But I have friends who are not. And they, you know, when their pay is cut by a third or a half or three quarters overnight, they seriously consider another career. So I recommend the support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for being here. Thanks for coming forth with your testimony.
Do you have three more? We have the last three. Mr. Chair, we have Mark Perman and Jim. Let's see. Anyway, we already had Mark Henkels.
Members, we are squeezing the time. If you do need to leave, I do understand it, but Mr. Olson and I are going to try to make sure we get everybody heard.
I believe that's it for all the people who signed up. It's Mark Henkels is the last one, and Mark Perman.
Mark Perman?
That's
nice. Here he comes. Please go right ahead. Come on up. Okay. If you guys could each take like 1 minute, I'd appreciate it. Reader's Digest condensed version.
1 minute. Okay, Mark Henkels, Western Oregon University. I teach public policy administration. Thanks for this 1 minute. Because I teach state and local government, it's really important. I can tell my students, you can do this. I just want to talk about investment. Basically speaking, when you look at tenure or full-time faculty, you're talking about investment. The institution, when it invests in the faculty, gets back that investment when they're full-time or tenure track. The research they do, the programmatic development that they're in charge of implementing, comes back to the institution in a way that for part-timers it can't. More importantly, on the flip side, faculty invest themselves in the institution when they're full-time. They're there, they're doing the bottom-up problem-solving. When students need problems, they need to have people there that listen to them, know the field, know the profession, know where to go. And full-time faculty are there. That's their primary purpose. And so I look at it more as we need concepts because concepts drive priorities. And the concept here is the virtues of having full-time committed faculty, well paid. Thank you.
Thank you. Well done.
I'm Mark Perlman. I'm a philosophy professor at Western Oregon University and the president of the faculty union there. And I teach philosophy, including philosophy of law. So I would like to give my defense of the chancellor and the community college presidents for being on the wrong side of this issue. And I learned something today from listening to them that I'm going to refer to this defense as the battered administrator syndrome. They are so used to being underfunded that the first thing they start wringing their hands about is, oh, my God, they're not going to give us enough money to do this. It's not going to work. And they're probably right. If this isn't funded, it's not going to work, obviously. Well, fund it. But, you know, many of the problems as far as, oh, we have to do administrative thing, we have to keep track of this or that. I mean, these are all intelligent people. They'll figure out the details. I don't think anybody should be worried about
details of implementation. We can figure out how to do the right thing if we have the resources to do the right thing. If we don't have the resources, then we're going to continue to have a system that's sliding down into the bottom of the American education system. But, you know, so I understand why they're worried, because, you know, I don't know enough about it, but the co-chair's budget didn't do higher education much help. It's not what we need. And if that's all we're going to get, then we're going to continue to have a subpar higher ed system, and we're never going to get out of this mess that we've dug ourselves into. But we have to get ourselves out of this mess. And, you know, if we're worried about how much it's going to cost, the question I have is, how much is it going to cost for Oregon to have the worst higher ed system in the country when it comes up for economic development, when corporations want to come here and there's not enough people with degrees in the areas that they need? And unfortunately, it requires spending money in advance to get benefits 10, 20, 30 years down the road. This is not the kind of thing that people like to have to do, is to spend the money and hope the investment comes through. But we have to do it. I mean, you know, my bottom line is we have to do this. And they're right. If we don't fund it, then it's not going to work. So we must fund it.
Thank you.
Chairman Buckley, my name is Barbara Roberts. No, I'm not our former governor. No, I'm not on your list either. Forgive me for not writing down my name there. And I'm nervous. You can hear it in my voice. I'm part-time faculty at PCC. I teach mathematics there. It's my third year there. And I'm here for several reasons. First, I don't receive health insurance from the college. And the way I receive health insurance is from FHIAP, which is a state run, which I'm sure you're aware of. So there, probably, hopefully, maybe some of the funding, instead of funding that, it can go towards our health our health at the community colleges or at the colleges.
Very good.
Okay.
Very good. One more point? Can you just one more point? We do have to close down. We have to give over the room.
One more point. I'm also on NOAA, and I'm also on food stamps, and I'm shy about sharing that with you. And again, there's funding perhaps that can go to other avenues instead of into those places. And again, I'm part-time faculty, and I'm embarrassed to say that, but it's true. Anyway, not embarrassed to say I'm part-time faculty. It's part. I'm embarrassed to say the state help that I'm receiving. And thank you for hearing me.
Thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your testimony. Thank all three of you. The level of funding, and I've said this before, that our funding of higher education in our state is an embarrassment to Oregon. And I appreciate all of you being here today to try to focus on this and see how we can move forward. Gentlemen, thank you for your time and your consideration. I'm going to close the public hearing. We're going to carry over. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2578. And Ms. Wilson? We're going to carry over House Bill 2579 to Monday, April 2nd, the Higher Education Subcommittee, and I'm going to close this committee hearing. Thank you very much. Thank you, John, for sticking with us.